Mike from Silver Farm. Today we bring you our exclusive interview with the great Dave Kranzler of InvestmentResearchDynamics.com. You've heard Dave on many of the podcasts I feature here, but I assure you, never like this. Dave is legendary in our space for his insightful market commentary. Today, though, I dig into Dave's experiences on the junk bond desk of Bankers Trust and we get into his vision of where we might be headed from here. In the show notes to today's episode, and at silverfarm.org, you'll find links to Dave's work, as well as a button to support us here at Silver Farm. We rely exclusively on your donations, so please, if you like what you hear and you want more, please help us out. From my family to you, enjoy the show. So, Dave, your normal interview has to do with your market analysis and stuff, but obviously you got to that after, you know, a bunch of experience. I know I've picked up that you used to work for Bankers Trust. And, you know, when we had communicated by email, you said that you had some interesting stories to relay. And we just was wondering if, I don't know, you'd kind of walk us through how you ended up where you did and then what that looked like once you were there.
Sure. Well, I when I came out of business school, I went to work at Bankers Trust in their high yield unit. And at the time, it was the only commercial bank that had a securities trading unit. And well, JP Morgan might have, I take that back. JP Morgan had one also. But Bankers Trust was pretty far into high yield. The desk actually started, I think, in 89. And they knew that Glass-Steagall was going to fall eventually. And so they had set up a subsidiary. And I'm not sure how they were able to get the necessary exemptions to have a securities trading unit. I'm sure there was some gerrymandering going on behind the scenes. But it was set up because Bankers Trust had, well, they had a very well-known derivatives business, and that was set up at the bank holding company. I have no idea what the regulations were that allowed them to do that at the holding company.
Do you think it was just an innovative idea on their part that they figured out nobody else was doing this and they could make money and were using, you know, I don't know, an area that wasn't regulated because it wasn't an issue? Or do you think that they twisted some arms and, you know, got some regulatory issues taken care of to make that happen?
No idea. No idea. I think the derivatives thing, probably because it was unregulated at the time, or fairly unregulated. And with this, in terms of the high-yield sales and trading unit, again, I don't know. I mean, you know, there was probably some sort of loophole. I think there was a loophole they exploited at BT and JP Morgan. And Bankers Trust had a huge advantage. Bankers Trust has always been a very aggressive lending bank. It's kind of the culture there. And so they had made huge headway into the high yield or junk bond bank debt lending business. And so the natural extension was to leverage off that because, they saw how much money Wall Street banks were making, you know, investment banks were making underwriting junk bond deals. And so that it was kind of a natural extension, and Bankers Trust had an in at these companies because they, you know, the bank debt for a high yield deal is kind of the heroin that makes the deal happen, so to speak.
Milken and his cast of characters helped transform global finance and spawn the trillion-dollar junk bond market. But the firm crashed in 1990. Milken spent 22 months in prison for illegal trades that boosted Drexel and its clients. 25 years later, the people who lived through all of it wear their Drexel career like a badge of honor, and they tell it all to Bloomberg Business. Well, Jason Kelly is here to walk us through the rise and fall of Drexel. Jason, and look, you started off the article with this Ken Mullis quote, which I love. You know, Ken Mullis recounting that when he first got hired, people said to him, you know, don't worry, maybe you'll get a real job at a real investment bank one day. I mean, nobody knew how big this firm was going to be, right?
Nobody had any idea of how big it was going to be, and no one certainly, even in 1990, had a sense that we'd even be talking about this 25 years later. It's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing. Okay, so what did the folks tell you about, you know, when they recounted the 25 years, what were the highlights that came out?
Right. Well, Betty, we were able to spend some pretty quality time with a lot of people who were there on the ground, in the trenches, as it were, at the X-shaped desk that Michael Milken had made famous out in Beverly Hills.
Because he wanted to see everybody's eyes, right?
He wanted to see everybody. He wanted everybody close by. He didn't want to have to turn around. And people really gravitated to him. They wanted to be near him. I mean, he really was the sort of the center of this universe, sort of literally and figuratively. And what they described was this really go-get-em entrepreneurial place. I mean, people got in, you know, Mark Adonasio, who now runs Crescent Capital, he owns the Milwaukee Brewers, you know, he's one of the sort of luminaries that came out of there, was talking about how in L.A. you got in at 5 in the morning, not 5:01, you got in at 5 a.m., or sorry, the day started at 5, you had to get in by 4:30. Michael Milken was there at 3:30. So, I mean, this is how it started, and clients would show up, and the roster that they had of clients, you know, these are brand names that we all know.
Well, they are. Let's talk about that, Jason, because Michael Milken, we now know, of course, he's head of the Milken Institute.
Right.
And he's had this comeback. But talk to us about some of the other, you know, alumni, essentially.
Sure. Well, it's interesting when you look at the people who were involved, you know, there's sort of these two sets. There are people who came out like Ken Mullis, Mark Adonasio, Leon Black, Gary Winnick, and others who worked there, who went on to these great careers. But also remember that back in the 1980s, nobody really knew who Carl Icahn was, or Nelson Peltz, or Boone Pickens. Mm. And these were the people who really benefited. Steve Wynn, Kirk Kerkorian.
John Malone,
all these guys. Ted Turner. I mean, these were the people who Milken and Drexel really put on the map through the invention, or through the really use of high-yield bonds or junk bonds.
Well, I was going to say, so the firm no longer exists, and it crashed, but the junk bond market is largely a result of what Drexel did, right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, what they essentially did was they opened up the market. What people told us as we were talking to them was that up until that point, finance was really binary. You were either investment grade or non-investment grade. And what somebody told me as we were talking through this was that this created this spectrum of risk. And so you could match up buyers and sellers, you know, buyers and issuers. And so suddenly companies that couldn't get financed before were able to get money. And it also gave fuel to these guys that we've been talking about,
yes,
Pickens and others, who could all of a sudden raise money to do these big takeovers.
Did you get the sense that they were setting rates commensurate with risk, or that somehow somebody knew in the back of their mind that they were, you know, sort of backstopped from above? Or was it just that, you know, they were playing in a pool, and if you take a large enough pool, you know, the rates are, you're going to lose a lot, you're going to have a lot of losses, but the rates are set high enough to do that? Or like I said, did you get the feeling that it was also taken as a given that if they got in too deep, they had, you know, further backstops?
Well, I mean, with securities underwriting, the banks just underwrite the deals. They don't take the credit risk. They don't take the capital risk. You know, it's a function of underwriting the bond deal and finding investors to buy it. And that market was already there. I mean, obviously Drexel had, you know, well developed it, and a lot of the people in the Bankers Trust high yield unit, meaning from bank debt on down, had worked at Drexel. So, you know, I mean, those guys knew how to get the business going and where the bodies were buried, so to speak, in terms of who the big accounts were that you needed to really focus on to get your deals done. But when I started there, I mean, it was, I actually, in 89, right as I was starting business school, that's when Drexel went belly up and you know, was the prosecutions were beginning for their indiscretions in the junk bond business. And the United LBO fell apart, and it was said that the high yield business was dead. I remember there were articles like that were circulating. And so, that my summer in between my first and second year was, so that was the summer of 1990. I took an internship at Bankers Trust, a summer job, and you were supposed to choose two out of three areas to rotate through. And one was restructuring, one was corporate finance, and one was high yield sales and trading. And I did restructuring and high yield sales and trading. And that's how I got to be on the trading desk and get to know the people. And having worked on the banking side of the business or the corporate finance side of the business before business school, it was like, you know what? This high yield sales and trading thing, there's something to it, because your day is done by 5 and you don't work weekends. So, and everyone had a lot of fun. So, that's when I graduated, I went right into that. And I think if I recall, and I'm pretty sure this is accurate, out of the top 10 business schools, I think there were only like 2 guys total that went into high yield sales and trading. Now, there were several, I'm sure, who went into high yield corporate finance, but there was only 2 of us who went into high yield sales and trading. So, and I was one of them. So, that's how I got there.
So in the course of underwriting, the only real thing that keeps them in line, the only real liabilities they have is reputational liability if they do a poor job of underwriting. I mean, you said they don't have any, you know what I mean? They underwrite the deals and pass them along to investors, so they don't really have any capital in that. So is it criminal liability with fraud if it's shown that they, you know, that they knowingly pass along misinformation to the investors to underwrite these deals? So what is their liability to do? What is
their
incentive
to do a
good job?
I mean, back then the market was a little more involved. The market itself, meaning the collective players in the market, were more active in setting how these deals got priced. So in other words, there wasn't the degree of official intervention in these markets, mm-hmm. and there wasn't liquidity flooding into it from the Fed and from other sources. So the markets, in a way, the markets really kind of set the pricing on the deal. And there's always going to be the issue of fraud in securities underwriting, but you do due diligence, and I saw a lot of shady deals get done, but at the end of the day, the investors were making the decision, and they got to do their own due diligence also. So, I don't know necessarily. Well, I guess I did see people outright lie to investors, but to a certain extent, the people buying these deals are big boys, so to speak, and they gotta do their own due diligence, make their own decisions. I mean, if you rely on a Wall Street salesman to make your investing decisions, then you're a total idiot and you deserve what you get.
So as you were there, you must have seen the culture change and evolve. You said they were setting themselves in the position because they saw the writing on the wall that Glass-Steagall was going to fall. How did you watch things evolve over the course of your career?
Well, I mean, back then things were a little bit different. Back then, you didn't have the extent of corporate and political correctness that you have now. You didn't have human resource issues that you have now. And so in that sense, it was a little more like the Wild West, especially our trading desk, situated on a bank trading floor, which was, mostly trading bank debt and money market instruments and treasury bills and repos. those were the primary desks. Well, there was the derivatives desk also. But you also had a compliance and risk management group that was a lot more proactive in enforcing the laws and enforcing credit standards. And it was harder to get get things, you know, to hide things from the, we call them the risk Nazis. It was harder to hide things from the risk control area and the you know, sort of the areas that were in charge of enforcing the regulations, the compliance area.
Was there a lot to dissuade people from trying to hide things from the risk Nazis? I mean, obviously, you know, that must have been a little bit of a cat and mouse game, but
yeah, if you got caught and you got in trouble and you were guilty, you lost your job and you lost your securities license. You were basically out of the business.
So you think that helped keep people in line, and then maybe that's what you're referring to with the lack of human resources. It seems like a lot of times now human resources really, you know, they give a lot of chances and they try to smooth over a lot of bad behavior. So are you saying that it kind of was more self-corrective back then, where people had
from the regulatory compliance standpoint? Yes. From the human resource side, what I'm saying is there was a lot more tolerance for the types of behaviors and comments that flow on a trading desk, or that can flow on a trading desk, than there are now.
I gotcha. Well, no, I understand. I mean, again, my background's from the fire service, and if people knew how we spoke in the firehouse, you know, there'd be all kinds of problems.
There were times on our trading desk when it was either, you know, it was very similar to a fraternity or even to an extent a male locker room, even though there were women on the desk.
Right.
And they just tolerated it. They didn't care because they were getting paid a lot of money and they didn't want to rock the boat.
Right. It was just sort of the rules of the game, or
right,
the stadium you were playing in.
That's right. Now, when I first started, I actually started out as a salesman. The trading function was full. And I remember when I was sort of cut loose, I was given a list of accounts no one wanted. Of course, that's how you start as a junior guy on a trading desk. Right. And I remember I was sitting there kind of looking at the list, you know, and I must have looked a little bit perplexed, or, you know, like, what do I do now? And one of the guys on the desk was actually a really funny guy. He had worked for DLJ, which was, you know, probably just a shade more conservative in terms of doing underwriting deals in the junk bond market than Drexel was. And a lot of ex-Drexel people ended up at DLJ. And, but he, you know, they were, at the time, the banks were paying big guarantees to guys who were already seasoned and experienced at existing desks, especially if they were high. You know, DLJ was the number one junk bond shop at the time. Mm-hmm. First Boston ultimately acquired, or Credit Suisse acquired DLJ. But I remember he looked at me and he's like, look, he goes, your job is to pick up the phone and reach into the mutual fund manager's pocket and grab a hold of as much money as you can and take it out of his pocket and put it into yours. That's your job. And I was like, oh, okay. And that kind of lit a spark, and, you know, I was off and running.
So what exactly were you selling? You were just selling the junk bond products that they were underwriting?
Well, the Bankers Trust was just then getting into the underwriting, and they were, because of their presence as the bank debt underwriter in a lot of these buyout deals, they would get themselves listed as a co-underwriter on a junk bond deal, and that would be worth not you wouldn't get a fee split, but you would get a percentage of the fee that the lead underwriter would get. So that was just starting, and what I was doing is, you know, the desk was making markets, and it did have inventory of bonds, because that's how you have to run a trading operation. And so my job was to look for ideas and call up the mutual fund managers that I was assigned to covering and pitch them on the ideas. And a lot of times the idea might come from, if one of the salesmen had an account that was a seller of bonds, of a certain bond, and it looked like a good idea, and we thought we could make some money trading the issue, then I would learn about the credit story and pitch the idea. So, I mean, back then, eventually there was there's riskless and there's proprietary trades. And a proprietary trade is when your trading desk takes down the position without having a buyer on the other side.
Right.
And you develop a buyer. And a trading desk will do that if they think they're able to buy the bonds at a good price. And then there's riskless trades when you have a fund that is selling some bonds and an account that wants to buy those bonds. And then you risklessly cross them. And at the time you would cross those bonds for as big a price spread as you could get. And also at that time, there wasn't much in the way of electronic automation or electronic trading of the junk bonds. Some of the junk bonds traded on the New York Stock Exchange Bond Exchange or something. I think that's what it was. One of the big exchanges had a bond exchange, but it was odd lots. It was mostly for retail brokers to sell, like, you know, Kroger bonds to a retirement account or something. So a lot of these bonds were just pure over the counter, and the only price that you would have would be prices that were observed in the interdealer market, which accounts didn't have access to. That was only for the trading desks, and we called it the street, and that was a network of interdealer bond brokers, and they were supposed to add some arm's length to the over the counter bond trading business, and technically you were supposed to trade a bond through an interdealer bond broker if you were trying to buy a bond that another dealer had and they were trying to sell it and they didn't have an account who wanted it and you had an account who wanted it. But that would eat into your spread. The ideal trade is if you had a bond that you underwrote or you co-underwrote or it was a special situation and you were basically the firm that had put a price on the bond or knew the true price level where they traded, and you would tee up your seller at a certain price and try and tee up a buyer at a price that was a lot higher than a 5% markup. And they didn't all, most of the time they weren't 5% markups, but a lot of, you know, there was a few times where, we crossed bonds for some spread.
So there was a lot more information asymmetry just because things hadn't been, there was no electronic markets, nothing that people could observe. It was a lot more opaque, I guess.
Yes, that's correct.
What were some of the more interesting situations, maybe some of the more nail-biting or hair-raising situations, yourself or some of the traders around you got into?
You know, first of all, one of the things that we did is that as the desk got going and started building momentum, some of the bank debt traders wanted to make the jump from bank debt trading, which was super boring, over to the junk bond side because we were making more money than they were and we were having more fun. And their desk was right next to ours. there was theoretically supposed to be a Chinese wall between the bank debt trading desk and our desk, meaning that people on the bank trading desk weren't allowed to give us information about what was going on because, the bank debt underwriting side of the firm would see the inside books to these companies. And a lot of times they would have to share that information with the trading desk when they're trying to make a decision on where to buy a piece of bank debt or, you know, where to position it or where it should even trade or, you know, whether to even stay away from a piece of bank debt if there was a seller out in the market. So, after a couple years, after about 2 years, I had set up a situation where we were trading some bonds out of the RTC. The RTC was the Resolution Trust Corp, and that was the government entity that was set up to, take all of the crappy bonds that Drexel had stuffed into the S&Ls. Mm-hmm. And at the time it was a very, very small, a fraction of the size of the TARP bailout but that's essentially what it was like. It was designed to smooth over what happened in the SNL industry from the Drexel situation and all the crap that Drexel had plugged into these SNLs. So, and this particular company was called Pomida. It was like a discount five and dime store. I forget where they were based, Midwest. And it was a crappy deal that Drexel had underwritten, and the RTC put them up for bid. And that fact was shared with the trading desk. And so I took a look at the financials and I was like, hey, you know, at a certain price, these bonds make sense because the company was operating and they had cash flow. And, these bonds were, you know, if you could buy them at the right price, you're going to make a lot of money on them. So I took the story and I showed it to some accounts, and this is when I was still a salesman, and I got a couple accounts teed up on it for some pretty big size. But there was also a very wealthy family. In fact, the family owns one of the NFL football teams. They had put an ad in a distressed bond rag saying that they had $100 million to invest in distressed debt, calls with ideas. And so I took the number, and no one else on the desk wanted it. They were fat and happy, seasoned salesmen. I took the number and called it, and I pitched the story. And so we got a handful of buyers lined up at a certain price. I think we had them lined up at like 60 cents on the dollar or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was 70, 65, 70 cents on the dollar. And it might have been a little bit lower than that because the spread that we made on the bonds wasn't 50%, but, and I pitched the story, and so what you did is you would show a bid in for the bonds to the RTC, and they were going to fly to the highest bidder. And so, what happened was I didn't know where the trader was bidding. He wasn't going to tell me because he knew that I'd be afraid to mark them up as much as we were going to mark them up. And the price that we marked them up to was actually turned out to be a great price. I mean, the guys who bought these bonds ended up making a lot of money because Greenspan inflated the money supply during the 90s, and there was all kinds of refinancing. But at any rate, so let's just say I had gotten my buyers teed up at 60, and the trader, the head trader at the time, he showed in a bid to the RTC of 40. So we're talking 40 cents on the dollar.
Wow.
And so we're talking about a 20 point. I think the spread was like 15 points, and we're talking about a 15 point spread from what we paid for them to what we flipped them into the buyers for. Now, there was only one problem with this. And that was, at the time, the NASDAQ 5% markup rule had already gone into effect. So what I had to do is go around to my buyers and say, look, you're going to be done on this trade, but we're going to have to write the trading tickets tomorrow. You know, blah, blah, blah. I had to, come up with some reasons why we weren't going to be able to actually execute the trade until the next day. And when my accounts all agreed to do it, the trader went into the RTC and bought the bonds. And I still hadn't known what price he bought them at until after he had bought them. But the bank had to position the bonds overnight. And I don't know how the trader smoothed over the markup issue other than because, you know, you do it overnight, it's still kind of transparent what you're doing. But it technically accounts as a as a principal trade, because we did have to settle the trade in our back office before we could send the bonds to the back offices of the buyers. So, I guess my point there is that was an example where we completely got around the NASDAQ 5% riskless trading rule, even though technically it wasn't really a riskless trade. We had the buyers lined up, and I just had to convince them that we couldn't write the tickets until the next day.
Right. So that, again, just because a little bit inside that five, the 5% trading rule says if you have them lined up and you're just the basic middleman and you don't have any real skin in the game, you're restricted to marking up by 5%. Is that about what it amounts
Yes.
to?
Yes, you can. A riskless trade was, you weren't allowed to mark it up more than 5%. But a riskless trade technically was defined as same day. You know,
right.
You just cross the bonds from buyer to seller. Right. We had to position these bonds overnight. The funny thing is about this story is this wealthy family who bought the bonds and they, you know, I think they all put them in their personal accounts. I mean, the families, you know, they're billionaires, multi-billionaires. And to settle the trade, we ended up getting checks from the two sons and the father, personal checks. And the back office was not going to honor them. And we were like, what? Are you serious?
Oh, no.
And I called the bank down in Florida of where one of the checks was drawn on. And, I said, hey, is this check going to be good? You know, it's for several million dollars. And the lady just laughed. She goes, yeah, don't worry about it. And I found out after doing research later down the road that this particular family happened to own this bank. But that was probably a whole other process that I didn't get to see the back office side, but I'm sure the guys who were running my desk had to go down to the back office and convince them to, you know, cash the check that they were good.
Yeah, it seems like that they had a lot of incentive to cash the check considering that, you know, they were already on the hook for the money. I mean, you know what I mean? If they bought the bonds and held them overnight, you know, your company's money had kind of already gone out the door. They needed to cover it. So they did have a lot of incentive to figure out how to make those checks work.
Right. Right. So that was one of the funnier stories. But then I moved over to the trading side. And at the same time, the head trader, the guy who basically ran the whole desk, had decided to bring one of the bank debt traders over. And I know the reasoning for that was because he knew that if he gave this guy a job, this guy would be obligated to share any kind of bank debt information with him, because this guy was still very friendly with a couple guys on the bank debt. And he'd been at the bank for quite a while, and he knew the corporate finance guys. And, so that was essentially an insider trading situation, you know, and that's an example of the kind of stuff that was going on. And I think it goes on even to a greater degree now, because the risk control and the compliance people have less incentive to enforce the rules because they're getting paid off to look the other way right now also.
Yeah, it seems like the incestuous relationships have just gotten thicker and thicker. And it's one thing you don't see that highlighted a lot. You know what I mean? Maybe in our community, we point out, you know, things like the revolving doors between, you know, regulators and the companies that they're supposed to regulate. But, you know, like I said, the incestuous nature of this stuff isn't really highlighted. Certainly not in the mainstream. But it's got to be a very small community that does this stuff. I mean, as you say, they have their own language, they have their own, you know, sort of code. I'm sure, you know, their own brother code, and things just work in a very, very unique way within this group.
That's right.
You were with Bankers Trust for how long in total?
9 years.
Obviously, Bankers Trust is not around anymore. Who were they absorbed by, or how did that go?
Well, after the Procter & Gamble debacle, when the derivatives area completely ripped off Procter & Gamble and got caught, and that was a no-no back then. You didn't do that because Procter & Gamble was, you know, one of the most highly esteemed companies in the country. And, you know, these guys got caught with their hand in the cookie jar, and Procter & Gamble and the regulators slammed the lid on the hand in the cookie jar. In fact, the CEO of Bankers Trust, who pioneered the derivatives business, he was canned. And he was replaced by a guy named Frank Newman, who came from, I don't know, I think he came from the Federal Reserve or something, and they put Paul Volcker on the board, you know, because they wanted to preserve their reputation, make it look like they cleaned everything up. I mean, meanwhile, beneath all that going on, the junk bond area was running amok. You know, in fact, I saw, and this is when I was trading, we were underwriting a really crappy junk bond deal. And it was toward the end of the year, and there weren't a lot of accounts around, and we hadn't gotten a rating on it yet. A lot of accounts can't buy bonds that aren't rated. And the account that kind of the salesman who covered the account that put us over the top on in terms of getting the deal done. And these deals, you wanted to, like, if you're doing it, this was a $70 million deal. If you wanted to get a $70 million deal done, you wanted to create $100 to $140 million worth of interest, because then the bond trades up in the aftermarket, and it's, you know, it means there was a lot of demand for the deal. It was probably a good deal. And because of the time of the year, but also because of the crappy credit it was, and it was a small deal, and it was supposed to come with warrants, but the upper management in the high yield area at Bankers Trust stripped the warrants from it, kept it for themselves, or kept it for the corporate, the high yield finance, corporate finance department, or put it in the bank account. I don't know where they went, but, so at any rate, this was an ex-Drexel guy, and he had some really funny stories from Drexel. He was a good guy, but he was buddies with, Moody's was supposed to give us a rating on it. We couldn't get S&P to rate it. And, this guy was buddies with the Moody's analyst, and in order for the account that was going to put the deal over the finish line to invest in it, it had to have at least a B rating, meaning a B minus. S&P would be, for single B ratings, it'd be B plus, B, or B minus. And the initial indication was they were going to rate it triple C plus. And, we couldn't have that happen. So, The salesman who was good buddies, well, not good buddies, but knew him from his Drexel days and had a working relationship with him. Like, we were given kind of, our desk was given kind of a drop dead date to get the deal placed. We were going to be in trouble or get yelled at, and it would have been unpleasant. And, the salesman took the Moody's guy out to play golf at this fancy country club that the salesman belonged to in New Jersey. And before that, he took him to lunch at a restaurant called Chanterelle, which was in Tribeca at the time. It was one of the, considered, it was probably one of the top 5 to 10 restaurants in the city. And when we get, you know, the next day we come into work, and lo and behold, the deal had a B minus rating on it, and it got done.
Wow. So for, yeah, for the price of an expensive lunch and a round of golf, they potentially cost investors a lot of money.
Well, yeah, and I don't remember what happened with these bonds. I think it might have worked out. I don't remember, but I mean, there was, I think Bankers Trust at the time, the standard junk bond underwriting fee was like 3%. I think Bankers Trust was getting a 3.5 or 4% fee on the bonds to underwrite those, meaning 3.5 to 4% of the face value, which was $70 million. Plus these guys in corporate finance had stripped the warrants. So, I mean, you know, warrants for equity in the company. It was a private company at the time. So, yeah, it was a very fat deal for Bankers Trust, even though it was a small deal. And there was a lot of pressure on our desk to get it done. And, you know, I mean, when S&P and Moody's were crucified, and they should have been, and there should have been guys going to jail during the mortgage meltdown, you know, in the CBO and CLO trust meltdown, when all those, you know, even the AAA rated paper, you know, went to hell in 2007, 2008, you know, the big short stuff.
Yeah.
And that stuff had AAA ratings on it at the highest level in those structures. In the ratings analysts should have gone to jail. I mean, I'm sure there was payoffs going on to get the ratings they were getting.
Yeah, it sounds like a little bit more than lunch and golf.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can attest firsthand that I've seen fraud in that area or coercion, you know. So that's what goes on in our financial system. And like I said, it's worse now than it was when I was doing it. Because back then there was some semblance of risk control and compliance that was enforced. Now the compliance officers look the other way so they can get a bigger bonus.
And again, you'll have to forgive me if my questions are sort of, you know, naive or mundane, but I'm just really trying to wrap my head around how, you know what I mean, how the industry gets from, you know, sort of whining and dining the ratings guys to bump them up, you know, from triple C to triple B minus to, you know, where we were in 2008 and, you know, things getting rated triple A that had no business being there. I mean, it just seems like, you know what I mean? There must have been some kind of an evolution in culture or regulation or, a compensation structure or a little bit of everything that led that gap to widen so far.
I think it was an evolutionary process by which, you know, starting in probably the mid-1990s, everything became a lot more loosey-goosey, you know? And if you recall, when Clinton got elected, there was a lot of financial deregulation that occurred, you know, which culminated with the Glass-Steagall thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, and when Clinton got elected, obviously he was getting away with all kinds of stuff. I think it was just a general breakdown in rule of law and ethics and morals at the highest level of the country, you know, highest levels of D.C., obviously with the president. Everyone knew he was corrupt, Clinton. Yeah. And, you know, he would, you know, all of the things he was accused of. I mean, it was probably what was going on with, you know, for him was a lot worse than what we were ever told. There's probably even worse stories that never made it to the public.
Yeah, no doubt.
And I think there was also, you know, Greenspan started printing money all throughout, well, really the late 80s, because yeah. When the stock market crashed in 87 and then again in 89, didn't crash as much in 89, and it's not that stock market swoon doesn't show up in the history books the way 87 does, but, you know, Greenspan applied the accelerator to the money supply, to the liquidity in the system. And every time he would pull back on it, another problem would develop. And so, you know, it kept going like that through the 90s. And I think the internet IPO bubble, I think that's where the real fraud and corruption started to fester. And, you know, long-term capital, that was another situation, and that was with derivatives. I mean, the derivatives were really the Wild West, and there was a movement to regulate them, and as, you know, your audience and my audience knows, there was famous powwows with Greenspan and Robert Rubin, and I think Larry Summers was involved, and there was a few other guys. I think Tim Geithner was involved at the time, and they basically convinced Congress not to regulate derivatives. And so it was like, you know, when you don't have any really meaningful form of government oversight on something Wall Street does, it's like letting the fox run the hen house. And corruption and you know, lack of ethics just started to run amok. And we saw that with the internet IPO and all the money that Greenspan had pumped into the system to address the various crises that happened in the mid-90s, you know, and that kind of culminated with long-term capital. And then remember the Y2K thing. Greenspan said he had to flood the system with liquidity because of quote-unquote Y2K, which was a non-event. And that's what culminated with the internet bubble. And then Greenspan tried to pull it out, the liquidity out, and that caused the internet bubble to pop. Easy money.
With easy money, it can make you look like you're a lot more skilled than you are, or makes things that, you know, make you take more risk. Cause things that should be, you know, riskier than they are, you know, again, it just pushes the incentives in the wrong direction because the easy money is sort of filling in the gaps where something that might be riskier than it otherwise would without it, if that's
right. Yeah. So, and you know, to answer, you know, to come get back to your question, you know, how did you know everything slip as badly as it did, so that what happened in 2008 happened, and you know, the big short scenario happened, and that's, you know, it got to the point, and it's still going on. Everyone's looking the other way, and there's tons of money flowing around. I mean, these guys, these guys are making more money than ever on Wall Street at the top. And they know that in order to grease the wheels, they got to sprinkle it around to the various entities that facilitate it, like the rating agencies.
Right. So, yeah, I guess, and so the solution is nothing can ever go down, ever, you know, lest we see, you know, how bad things really have become.
When this thing collapses, the tide is going to go out, and it's going to expose like corruption that'll blow people's minds. But I'm sure at that point they'll have some sort of propaganda event or some sort of false flag event so that it takes people's minds off of that. You know what I mean?
It's hard to imagine what it's going to take. You know, I know that you and I both share a fairly stark, you know, vision of where things inevitably are going to head when this stuff unravels. It just seems like it's very hard to, the larger the false flag becomes, it's much harder to control the outcome of it. You know, we've bred a lot more dependency into the system over the last few years. There's a lot of very dependent people that are not going to fare very well, you know, when this gravy train stops, because as much of this, printing currency has been going, you know, to the 1% of the upper echelon, enough of it is trickling down to make, you know, to allow people to sustain existences, that otherwise wouldn't be, that would otherwise have to find something productive to do. And if that goes away quickly, I think that it's going to be very stark and very painful for these people.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, part of the problem is that the general public out there, they know things are bad, but I don't think they're willing to believe that they're as bad as they really are. And I've always said, you know, for guys like you and I, you know, we're willing to look at the truth. And, you know, I think that what's really happening is even worse than you and I understand. And I remember when I first got into all this stuff, you know, I left Wall Street in 2000, and when you step away from, Wall Street, you know, and leave like I did, and you look back, it's like, you're like, wow, I can't believe what I saw happen. And I started getting into the gold and silver and mining stocks and then, you know, looking at, you know, a lot of the things that are now widely publicized by the so-called alternative media. But, you know, this was back in 2000, 2001, 2002. This was the dark side. And, you know, I was willing to have an open mind with it because I was shorting internet stocks in 1999 and 2000. And I knew how fraudulent most of these companies were and how insane the stock market had gotten, you know, despite the fraud. And I remember a good friend of mine, one of my best friends from New York, called me up and I was living in Denver, and this was around 2003, and I was trying to educate him on, you know, open your eyes, look what's going on. And he said, you're seeing black helicopters. You know, like one of the things I said, you know what? Eastman Kodak has so much debt and derivatives buried on their balance sheet, they're going to eventually go bankrupt. And lo and behold, they did. But I remember, I can't remember if it was right before the 2008 collapse or right after. And he called me up and he said, I can't believe how right you've been about all of this. I take that back. You're not seeing black helicopters. And he's like, you know, what do you think's going to happen next? And, you know, at that point, you know, I had already read The Road, and I thought eventually this was going to end up where it looks like it's going to end up, which is some sort of nuclear conflict. And I just said, look, you don't want to know what I think because you won't believe it, just like you didn't believe it 8 years ago or 6 years ago. So, I guess maybe just to kind of wrap this up, I read a book. I finally got around to it. It was published, I think, in 87. It's Presumed Innocent by Scott Turow. And on an out-of-context basis, toward the end of it, you know, almost at the very end, there's a great quote in there that applies to our situation. And the gist of it is, for as hard as it is to see the truth, it's even harder to believe the truth. And I think that that element of human denial, I've came to the conclusion a long time ago that denial was probably the strongest human defense emotional defense mechanism. And I think that there's a lot of people out there who actually see the truth, but when they look at it, they just don't want to believe it's true because the implications are so horrific versus how we were all brought up and what we were brought up to believe, you know? And so I think the denial kicks in and they're just not willing to believe the truth.
Yeah, no, it's very true. The other aspect of it too that I've come to observe and has made me change a lot of what I do is that there's a large market for people speaking the truth. You know, when you whittle it down for the people that want to hear the truth, there's a market for speaking the truth. You know, and the common saying amongst this group is, you know, doom porn sells. People want to hear about the doom and gloom, but people are not anywhere near as interested in what they can do on an everyday basis to make small steps towards insulating themselves and making themselves, you know, more resilient, you know, in any ways, both, you know, money-wise, physical, mentally resilient, you know, to what we believe is the inevitable thing. I mean, there's just seems to be a lot of gawking going on in the, you know, the truth media community where it's nothing but, you know, constant negative headlines. And although they may be true and they may be relevant, at some point it just makes this din to me. It makes this din that, you know, I've honestly had to take a step back from because things are going to hold together way longer than any of us would ever believe, you know, and in the meantime, we'd probably all be smart to be doing what we can to try to get ourselves as right with what we see the future is going to be as possible. And I think it's just a lot of paralysis that can come from, you know, in immersing yourself in doom porn exclusively.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I also think that the reason why a lot of people aren't willing to take steps to protect themselves, like buy physical, et cetera, is because once you head down that road, that means that you've accepted the inevitability, the truth of what's happening and how it's probably going to unfold. And I think, you know, that's part of the denial thing is like, you know, I'm just not going to take my money out of the bank and move money into physical because at the end of the day, I just can't see this happening, you know, even though I see it right in front of me.
Right. But, you know, I mean, there's still an aspect where we all kind of try to keep our foot in both worlds at the same time, even for those of us that have, you know, taken steps to buy physical or to insulate ourselves, you know, financially, you know, those of us that have done it for a while suddenly look around and say, you know, it might have been smart to not put all of our, you know, all of our eggs in that basket because things have still continued for a lot longer than we thought they would. Things have, you know, there's still been investments. Things have still continued to go up, you know, until they don't. And so it also seems that really prudent, you know, to kind of try to keep your feet in both worlds at the same time.
Well, I agree. I think, you know, I mean, I'm with you there. I gotta conduct my affairs as if what I think's gonna happen isn't gonna happen because everyone else is. And I wanna enjoy what I can while I can. And I think that's what everyone needs to do is, you know, enjoy what you can as much as you can while you still can because, you know, you could wake up one day and the rug is ripped out from underneath us. And I think it will be. And I think we're getting closer to that.
Your current work, though, focuses on things that people can do in this environment to continue to generate wealth, right? Your mining stock journal and your short sellers journal is about trying to you know capitalize on this system before things go dark, and you know make some fiat which you can use to become better prepared in the process.
Yes, that's right.
All right, so why don't you just tell us a little bit about that again. I mean, I'm sure some of our listeners are somewhat familiar with it, but we always get new people. So why don't you just tell us about what you're working on and what you spend your time doing now?
Sure. So, I mean, I have a real small investment fund that I manage with two partners. But it, you know, it's very small. And my primary focus is on, I publish what I call the mining stock journal and a short sellers journal. And the Short Sellers Journal is once a week. It's $20 a month. It comes out on Sundays. And I give my view. I present what economic data came out for the week. I present my view on what the data means and how it could affect the markets. I comment on the markets themselves, and then I present some short ideas. And, you know, so for like two weeks ago, there was a lot of negative housing market data that came out, even though a lot of it was spun somewhat positively. And the issue focused on, the housing market. New subscribers get a handful of the previous issues, not all of them because there's just too many of them. And, you know, in addition to the current issue, plus a few other goodies. And then the Mining Stock Journal is bi-weekly. It comes out every other week on Thursday evening. And that focuses on the precious metals market, what's going on the trading side, what's going on, as far as I can tell, in the physical market. You know, I have access, or I get some reports that most people aren't even aware that they're out there. And it's connected with the fund I manage. And so I get, you know, I share a lot of that information in the journal. And then I, you know, typically try to present a new, the investment ideas focus on junior exploration stocks. But, you know, I also include information. You know, sometimes if I see a good trading opportunity in a producing stock that I believe is a high quality producing stock. Like today there was a mining stock that had a, let's call it a hiccup in its stock price. And, I sent a notice out to my subscribers. I said, hey, you know, you can go back to the issue where I presented this idea. Nothing's changed from that. In fact, it's gotten better for these reasons. And, I think this is a temporary situation and now's a great time to buy the stock. So, that's the Mining Stock Journal, and that's also $20 a month. And I offer a 50% discount on either journal to someone who subscribes to the other one. So it's essentially 20 each or 30 for both.
Excellent. Well, it seems like it's certainly contrarian direction journals that you're writing, being that, you know, the Fed is and the PPT are constantly pushing the stock market ahead and keeping their thumbs on the precious metals. But obviously that's the kind of climate where you're going to find deals and opportunities to, you know, with good research to capitalize. So.
Oh, it's completely contrarian. And kind of what's amazed me is given the trend in the precious metal sector the last couple months and given the huge run up in the stock market over the last year, or 18 months, I've had very little turnover in my subscriber base. You know, not very many, have dropped because they get discouraged by the market. A lot of my short ideas have really worked well.
Yeah. I was going to say that they haven't dropped you because, you know, your track record's pretty good. You know, with your picks, despite, you know, like I said, the macro environment.
Right.
All right, Dave. Well, I appreciate your time. And, unless you have anything else to add, we can wrap it up. It's, your site. Again, we should make sure we mention it's investmentresearchdynamics.com. I will have links to all of that stuff in the show notes to this episode. So if people want further information about your products, you write pretty much almost every day.
Just about every day.
And your insights are, you know, they're great and they're very helpful. And it's definitely a perspective that is, unique. So I definitely encourage people just to go there and check out your free work. I think that it's got a huge amount of value. Yeah. Unless there's anything else you want to add, I'll, wish you a good afternoon and, hope you're, going to be well on the mend soon.
Oh, thanks. Well, I appreciate you having me on here and, look forward to the next time.
All right, Dave. Take care.
You too.